Amen.
Amen. Great to be with you again today. This was a great week for us because my new little granddaughter was born this week. Amelia Florence Rolfe, and she's doing great. I got to hold her. She's precious and seems real chill. Her mom's doing really well, Lauren. Danny looks like it's going to take him 18, 19 years to recover. But no, it's awesome. We're so excited. And so I'm excited whenever I see kid stuff. So all the VBS decorations being up. I was seeing people coming in and wondering what's the theme of these signs that are out here. Well, it has to do with VBS. So that's the deal. But keep that in prayer. Where a lot of kids are going to be able to come in this week and hear about the Lord and have a great time together. So we're excited about that. But today we've come to a great chapter, 1 Samuel chapter 17. And so if you have a Bible, you can turn over there. This is one of the most well-known Bible stories ever. And we always tell kids about David killing Goliath because it's such a great, the little guy beating the big guy. Usually when we tell the story, we leave out the part about him cutting the head off Goliath and walking it into the king. We clean it up, but it's an amazing story because every one of us wants to believe that sometimes when you're outnumbered, you can get the win. It can work for you if you believe in God and trust him. The problem is, in life, Goliath usually wins, let's face it. But it's good to know that once in a while that doesn't happen. And so we love this story. But as we look at this chapter, there are some amazing lessons that we can learn through this. And so let's just jump right in. What was happening in those days, the first few verses, talk about the armies of Israel. Now, to remind you, Saul was the king. David was introduced into the story in the last chapter, but in this chapter, he plays a prominent role, but it seems like the chronology is a little confusing, and that's maybe because you can force the chronology, but maybe it's just that Hebrew literature tended to group things in events, not necessarily in chronology, so don't trip out about that. They're at the Valley of Elah. The Valley of Elah is a really strategic location in Israel. Israel was at war with the Philistines. Philistines had superior powers, but Israel had a great unity. So the Valley of Elah is a place where there were a lot of major wars that were fought there, because in the Valley of Elah, if you could control that channel, you can divide Israel with the southern kingdom, with Judah and Benjamin down below you, and up above you, the other 10 tribes. So the plan of the Philistines was, we make a strong stand here, and then we can move out in both directions and defeat them. So it was a very strategic location. So there they are having a battle back and forth. And it was, the Jews were at a disadvantage in this battle for sure. But as it was going, all of a sudden in verse 4, a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. A cubit is the distance between your elbow and the tip of your middle finger. So for me, that's like 21 inches, but generally they say it was, in those days, the size that people were, it was about 18 inches. So a cubit is the spread between your thumb and your little finger when you spread your fingers out, so generally considered around 9 inches. So he was 9 feet, 9 inches tall, if this is, now there in the Septuagint, it has him being smaller, more like 6'9", which still would have been a giant in those days, but most likely he was this big. Now, in case that already makes it sound like a fantasy, there are people who have been this tall or almost this tall, even in fairly recent history. Back in the 80s, a guy died who was 8'11", and he was still growing at the point when he died. Now, usually when this happens, it's because they have a disease called acromegaly and a pituitary adenoma, And this is Malcolm Gladwell in his book on David and Goliath. It's a great book. But he has neurologists who describe this condition, that this guy who died at 8-11 had this condition. And what it does is it's a tumor on the pituitary gland that makes your body just continue to put out human growth hormone. So you get bigger, all of your limbs get huge, you just don't stop growing. So this isn't something that's completely unheard of, or it's not like this is a made-up story. This was something that medically Israeli neurologists tell us was around in those days, and they've seen it in various skeletons and stuff that they found from people who died. But he was a big, impressive guy. He had a bronze helmet, verse 5, on his head. He was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of his coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. It was like 126 pounds. It was a big coat. And he had bronze armor on his legs and a bronze javelin between his shoulders. But the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, like a 4x4. And his iron spearhead weighing 600 shekels, or about 20 pounds, and a shield bearer went before him. So he's massive. He's armed for close-up combat. Everything that he's using, the sword, the big heavy javelin, it's like he needed somebody to be close to him for him to be able to fight them. Now, why did he have a shield bearer walking in front of him? One of the symptoms of a pituitary adenoma is that your vision goes, because it affects your optic nerve, and they typically will see double and everything is blurry. So he was probably, it's why he was ready to do close-up combat, because he couldn't see very far away. And at the same time, this guy with the shield was probably like his seeing eye dog, just helping him to know where to go and where to aim and where to drop his sword. So again, very feasible that, you know, this could be happening. And so there he is. And he stood and cried out in verse 8 to the armies of Israel and said to them, "Why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine and you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." This wasn't that unusual in those days. Rather than all of the bloodshed that would be suffered by both sides in a battle, they're fighting over a particular location. It's like, look, let's each send our toughest guy and see what happens. Whichever guy wins, your side wins, we will retreat, we will surrender. And the same thing goes for you. Well, problem is, they have this big giant, and the tallest guy in Israel is the king, Saul. And he's not about to go out there and fight someone who's way bigger than he is. The one thing a big guy doesn't want to see is somebody bigger, because like, uh-oh, you outdo me at what I do. And so there he is, and he begins taunting them. "Isn't there somebody among you who can do this? I defy," he says in verse 10, "the armies of Israel. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Then along comes David. He had been back there taking care of his father's sheep. Now, this chapter says that he would sometimes leave Saul to go back and take care of sheep. So maybe at this time he was working for Saul as a musician, but he had gone home to take care of sheep, and his brothers were in the battle. And so his dad wanted to find out what's going on in the battle. And so he sends David with some cheese and stuff and said, "Go check on your brothers and see how things are going." So he gets there. His brothers are there. David then, as he was there talking to them, he heard this giant Philistine, Goliath. As they were fighting in this war, he heard this shouting, and it says that, you know, David ran to the army, greeted his brothers, and as he talked with them, verse 23, there was the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines, and he spoke according to the same words. So David heard them, saying what he had said before. And all the men of Israel ran away and were dreadfully afraid. And they're like, do you know what will happen? If somebody will go fight him, it's tempting, because Saul already told us, if you can beat Goliath, you get a huge cash award, tax-free. Your family will never have to pay taxes. Your father's house and all your brothers and everybody tax-free for life. And you get to marry a princess. Now, David ended up marrying the princess, and she was a real mess. You really shouldn't marry a princess, but that sounded good to this little redheaded kid as he's hearing it. And he's like, what? And he's running around. So what'll happen? And his brothers, like his oldest brother, Eliab, is like, you're so prideful. You're just here to watch. Who do you think you are that you might do something like this? And so, you know, they were mad at him. And David said, what did I do in verse 29? Is there not a cause? Isn't somebody going to do something? So David said, I would fight him, you know. And when that was reported to Saul, he thought, there's some guy that wants to fight Goliath. Let me check this guy out. So down in verse 32, David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. And Saul said to David, you're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him. You're just a kid, and he's a man of war from his youth. But David said to Saul, your servant used to keep his father's sheep. And when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it and struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it came after me, I caught it by its beard and struck and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God. David's like saying, I know how to deal with somebody stronger than me. Lions and bears, stronger than me. But I know how to grab them by their weak spot. I know how to get a hold of them by that which makes them vulnerable. If you control the head of a lion, you control the lion. So he goes, those animals are more dangerous than this guy. I got this. And so Saul's like, you know, and he says, by the way, it was the Lord who delivered me from the lion and the paw of the bear, and he'll deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. So Saul said, okay, go. Down there in verse 38, Saul said, here, you better take my armor. So Saul's a huge guy. David tries on the armor and he can't even move a step. He's like, this ain't gonna work. And so Saul's like, okay. So David, down in verse 40, he took his staff in his hand, and he chose for himself five smooth stones from the brook. Now, when we go to Israel, we go down to the Elah Valley always, and you walk through there, and there are tons of stones, and people always pick up a rock to take with them as a souvenir. And I think as soon as our bus pulls away, the Israeli tour industry comes and unloads another truckload of rocks. But he picked carefully these five stones, and he put them in a shepherd's bag in a pouch, which he had, and his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. He has a sling. This isn't a slingshot like Dennis the Menace used. This is a leather, a piece of leather with two straps attached to it, and you put the rock in the pouch, and you swing it and swing it and swing it and swing it, and you release one of the strings, and the rock goes flying. Now, there are people to this day that are amazing with a sling. They were a common weapon back then for certain soldiers. There are people, they used to hunt birds by knocking a bird out of the sky with a sling. That's how impressive some people are with a sling. I've played with them a lot, but I couldn't hit a bird out of the sky unless it was like Big Bird. But there are people who can shoot these rocks and hit a target from over 100 yards away. And so it was a powerful weapon, but also really a mobile weapon. So it's not like he's just going, I'm just going to go shoot him with my dart gun. You know, no, he knows what he's doing. And there were armies that always had those who were the sling guys on the fringes because they could maneuver themselves and get an angle and hurt somebody. These slings, by the way, when they swing them, it's not like whoosh, whoosh, like that. It's they swing it 5 to 6 times per second. So it's like whoosh, and it puts out a trajectory, according to Israeli ballistics experts. It can put out a trajectory with the right stone equivalent to the knockdown power of a 45. So they can do some serious damage. It's a powerful weapon. And so he has his rocks and he's ready to go. So the Philistines lumbering down this hill, and it says the men who bore the shield went before him again, probably telling him where to go because he has no need for a shield with what he's doing. But this guy's like, okay, this way, this way. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, it says that he looked about like he's looking around. Things are all kind of foggy for him. He sees David and he disdained him, for he was only a youth, ruddy and good looking. So he's like, you guys sent me Opie Taylor to fight? You know, as he's getting his focus. And the Philistine said to David, and he was a pretty good trash talker, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? Malcolm Gladwell points out, it's interesting that he says sticks when he only had one stick. But again, with this pituitary anoma, you would see double a lot of times. And so he saw this blurred with, thought there were a couple sticks. The Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, come to me that I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. That's pretty good trash talking. That's like, but David is a poet. You don't out trash talk him. He's like Conor McGregor. So he says, you come to me with a sword, with a spear, and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord, Yahweh, does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. Only he said it in a high, squeaky voice. So he's like, okay. So when the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, he's feeling his way down the hill. David hurried. He ran and probably took a circuitous route. As he's looking for a target, as he's looking for, where can I aim my first shot? And he ran towards him. And David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone and he slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead. Now, again, with this pituitary adenoma, a person's skull would be very thin. Because as this disease causes you to produce too much human growth hormone, your head would get huge, like Barry Bonds. But then it would be very vulnerable. They actually have found archaeologically that they actually had special tools designed to be able to pry a stone out of someone's forehead when this would happen. See, a sword would injure someone, but they could still fight until they bled out. But you get hit in the head like this, knocks you unconscious immediately. And so he hit him in the forehead. The stone sank in. He fell on his face to the earth. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, struck the Philistine and killed him. But he didn't even have a sword. Therefore, David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword. This is the PG-13 part. He took the guy's sword out and killed him with it, and cut off his head. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. They're like, oh, we lost, let's go. They're running. And then you can read on. Then all of the Israeli soldiers pursued them, including David. And they're killing them with every weapon imaginable. Then they're taking all their stuff from their tents and everything, David ends up taking this armor and he puts it in his own tent. He's like, I got to show this to Dad or he'll never believe this story. But then he ends up, Saul is like, who is this kid? Whose dad is he? Which is maybe because he didn't remember who he is, but mostly he needed to get the record of who his dad is because that's who would be tax exempt. And so, you know, he got that information and his general Abner went and got David and brought him into the palace to meet with King Saul. And David's hanging onto this head as he comes in. Really a fascinating scene for sure. And again, we usually leave it out of the Sunday school lessons, that part of it. But what an amazing and inspiring victory that little David could take down big Goliath. It's huge because in our lives, we will always face enemies that are bigger and stronger, more powerful than we are. And usually, you're going to lose those battles unless you figure out what David had figured out here. Now, I would submit to you that there are basically four factors that gave David this victory. First of all, preparation. It all starts with being ready. He had been training and practicing and preparing for this moment. He had been beating bears and lions and doing everything that he could do. He was in incredible condition so that he'd be able to run and get this angle. He had time out there watching sheep with nothing to do, and he's practicing with that sling. He got really good with it. He got really deadly with it. And so if he hadn't been prepared, it would be like if I just try to take him out with a sling, you know, the rock could go behind me. But he was prepared. Secondly, he was somebody who had a strategy. He didn't just say, I'm going to go have a sword fight with this guy. No, that's his deal. I have a different approach that might give me an advantage. I am more mobile. I'm good with a sling. If I can get the right angle, I can take down this big guy in the same way that David's strategy with the lion was to get a hold of its mane, control the head, control the lion. And so he uses wise strategy in doing this, and that's why it wasn't that preposterous that a guy with an accurate shot from a sling could do a whole lot of damage and ultimately be able to kill the giant. But the third factor that we see is his courage. It's like, it doesn't matter how prepared you are, and it doesn't matter how good of a strategy you might have. At some point, you just have to decide, I'm going to go for it. Fear is the ultimate enemy of everything worthwhile. Fear should never be our motivation in why we do or don't do what we do or don't do. We shouldn't do things just because they're scary, but we should never say, that's scary, so I'm not doing it. Don't think that David wasn't scared. I'm sure he was. But at the same time, he had this courage that, and by the way, David was prepared to die. He faced death all the time. In his Psalms, think about the 23rd Psalm. He's like, the Lord is my shepherd. Even if I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. And ultimately, in the end of the psalm, I'll dwell in the house of the Lord forever. So for David, fear was not going to be a factor in what he decided to do. It wasn't going to play a part in his strategy. The last thing is that ultimately, he had faith in God. After he had prepared, which a part of his preparation was the time he spent in the wilderness, just spending time with God, getting to know him, learning to listen to God's voice, his preparation had to do with God. His strategy, no doubt, was bathed in prayer as he considered what's the best way to go. His being willing to do something that was scary was something that he could do because of his trust in God. Ultimately, he would give God all the glory when it was over, and he let people know, hey, God can do this. If God can do it, I think this is a smart strategy. This is what I'm going to do. And it worked. And it ended up really serving him well and rescuing Israel from being in a spot where they probably could have been overrun by the Philistines had this not happened at this point. So we look at it and we go, preparation, you know, plus strategy, being smarter, plus courage, and finally, God's glory, a faith in God, is a powerful combination when you put all those together. The truth is, for every one of us, we face giants. There are things in our lives that look like they're too big for us to take on. It may be a problem with a relationship or an issue at work or being able to find a career or trying to deal with a wayward child or, you know, whatever it is in life that somebody's against you. What do we do? Well, first thing we have to do is to be prepared. Nothing really good happens in life if you don't take care of yourself and prepare yourself for whatever it is that you're going to face. If your life's never going to be what it could be, if you don't eat healthy, exercise, and get enough sleep, and spend time just alone to reflect and take care of yourself psychologically, if you don't take care of yourself, nothing else good happens. You become a victim. You become the guy who gets crushed by the giant. So we need to prepare. Live our lives not for whatever I'm going through right now, but live my life in such a way that I'm preparing the way for what may happen in the future. But then we also have to use strategy in life. We have to decide what's the smartest thing to do in this situation that may bring about the kinds of results that I need. And this is tricky because typically, when someone does something against us, we tend to want to beat them at their own game. And sometimes that may work. Like, Goliath is a decent trash talker. David's a better trash talker. But in life, a lot of times, somebody comes out with their best process, and we want to beat them at that process. And that usually doesn't work well. I mean, I see this on the internet, when if somebody says something bad about you, you want to say something back. It plays right into their hand. It drags you into the same thing happens politically. You lower yourself to the level of whoever it is that's there. I'll never forget one time Pastor Chuck told me somebody had said something against me and I was going to get them back. And Chuck said, Dave, don't ever get in a pissing contest with a skunk. I found out later he was quoting Dwight Eisenhower talking about Senator McCarthy. But I learned that lesson, that if somebody's doing this, I don't need to respond back in the same way. Sometimes the smartest approach, the smartest strategy, is for me to, for instance, be nice back to someone. That makes them look stupider than if I say things that try to make them look stupid, and then they say other things, because a skunk will make up lies, they'll do anything, they won't hold back. So when it comes to strategy, we need to understand what is the smartest way to approach this problem. I read some statistics that amazingly, and I think it was in that Gladwell book as well, 65% of wars are won by an inferior military force who use a creative strategy against the stronger force. And I read this and I started thinking about it, and I think about Vietnam. Like, we were the strongest military in the world. We came into Vietnam. Now, we could have learned the French had been there for many, many years fighting against the Viet Cong, and they hadn't defeated them. But they're French, come on. So it's like, oh no, we go in there with Agent Orange and carpet bombing and mining the harbors and everything. We should be out of there in a week. No, because we weren't prepared for jungle warfare. We weren't prepared for what they would do. I remember when I went to Vietnam and hearing Vietnamese perspective on what they call the American War, we call it the Vietnam War, they showed, like, some of the things they did psychologically got in the heads of Americans. Like, they didn't have a bunch of landmines and things like that. They didn't have that technology, but they would make these huge, like, bear traps. And when an American soldier would step in one, and that trap would clamp into their leg, and they're screaming, it made everyone scared. See, we weren't used to fighting a war in a jungle. They also dug these little tiny tunnels everywhere, and they'd pop up out of the ground behind the American troops. And we're at a place called the Coochie Tunnels, and Steve Bailey and I, and there were somebody asked, why are the tunnels so thin? And they said, so the fat Americans can't get through them. So then they asked if anybody wanted to climb in them, and I'm like, I'm going to show you. And so I start crawling through the tunnel. It was pretty tight, but I'm working my way through. Steve Bailey was behind me, but he got claustrophobic and had to back out. But I made it through, but I thought, this is psychological warfare, that you feel like it's closing in on you. And so ultimately, you can claim that we won that war, but it doesn't look like it. It looks like way superior in every way except strategy. But all you have to do is go back to the American Revolution. The British Army was the most powerful army in the world, but they knew how to fight on big fields. So they would march in a straight line with red uniforms, thank you very much, so you can see them from a mile away. It says, like, hit me. And then the Americans would hide in the trees and stuff and take pot shots at them from behind and above. They really didn't have much of a chance at that because their technique wasn't what's best for this warfare. And we saw the same thing as we're fighting in these, you know, desert countries. We're pulling out of Afghanistan, but let's face it, how come a bunch of camel jockeys could hold off the Russians for so many years and then us? And everything that we would do is like, how do you beat somebody who hides in holes in the sand? It's just, it's problematic. But it's an important lesson in that ultimately, it's not about power, it's about strategy. What's the smartest approach that you can take? Now, I think I shared with you maybe before when I was back in New Jersey, Lloyd Pulley's church, Calvary Chapel Old Bridge, they bought this van and they outfitted it with 3D ultrasound machines. They had doctors and nurses in it. They gave free pregnancy tests and they would park it in front of Planned Parenthood. Now, for years, Christians have tried to win the battle against abortion. And we really haven't gotten much progress. And a lot of approaches have been tried. But for one thing, if you make abortion a Christian issue, which I don't think it is, then you're already losing more than half the population who doesn't believe, even if the Bible said don't have abortions, which it doesn't, you know, it'd be like, well, we don't believe the Bible. But what these guys are doing, brilliant. Park in front of Planned Parenthood, they're nice to people. They come in and go, hey, you want to see a picture of your baby? Would you let, you know, and they're giving out free medical care. The funny thing is, last year, they had 157 women who decided not to have abortions because of their van. And I'm like, that actually works. Now, again, to me, that's why I say abortion's not a Christian issue. It's a human issue. When I saw my little Amelia born this week, I'm like holding her and thinking, it's legal to have taken her life from her at this point? This is insane. It's not about the Bible. It's about common human sense. So how best to communicate that? The ultrasound, much more powerful than the protests. The funny thing is, Lloyd told me, the Planned Parenthood people haven't complained at all about us parking in front of their places because they see we're trying to help the women. We're offering free medical care, giving them an opportunity. And they said, they haven't complained at all. The people who complained are the Christians who are out there picketing, waving signs of aborted fetuses, calling women murderers as they're walking into the clinics. Different strategy. If your strategy doesn't work, find a smarter strategy. And so that's true in every area of life. It's all about the strategy, the wisest approach, what is likely to work, and it will probably be more unconventional. Now, also, not everyone has to have the same strategy. Maybe with the people who are out there screaming at women, maybe some of them talk people out of getting an abortion. Great. Just like I teach here, but I have friends who go down and scream at people at the pier and preach. Some people get saved from it. Okay. You know, during the pandemic, it's like, okay, the government says shut down the churches. There are some churches who are like, no way, we're not shutting down. You know, in fact, we're going to cough all over each other. No masks here. We're going to spread QAnon rumors. And you know, okay, people got saved at those churches. There were other churches that was like, no, we're afraid, and huddled up in a corner, did online. People got saved at those churches. We took a different approach. It seemed wise to me. It was just like, let's just keep doing what we're doing. And far as I'm concerned, this is the online broadcast. And if you're sitting in the audience, you're a part of our volunteer production staff, because I need people to laugh at my jokes. So three different approaches. People got saved at our church. So I don't need to judge somebody else's tactics. In fact, in this case with David, once he took Goliath out, he didn't tell everybody, okay, go get your slings. No, now they took their swords and spears and everything else and chased these guys. There's a place for everyone. Don't criticize somebody else's tactics. Just pick your own. If there are people who are fighting the battle for or against, you know, racial sensitivity and whatever, it's okay. You find your strategy. As God leads you, don't bother criticizing other people at their strategy. I remember when I was in seminary and I was having a conversation with several of my fellow students, and we were being critical of Billy Graham because, you know, he had liberals and Catholics and everything up on the platform with him, and we just thought that was horrible. And one of my professors walked up and overheard the conversation, and he goes, gentlemen, let me ask you a question. If you're at the pier and you are fishing and you haven't caught anything, and there's another guy down there with a whole stack of fish, are you going to tell him how to fish? So don't take issue with other people's strategy. If your strategy is unique, that gives you a distinct advantage. But you don't need to get focused on everyone else's strategy. But you better strategize, because to be smart is to give you an opportunity to take down giants. But at the same time, it takes courage. Every decision that you will make out of fear will probably be a wrong decision. When I was a kid, people used to think I was fearless. I was scared to death. I just didn't let fear stop me from doing crazy things. Anyone who does things, unless there's something, you know, psychiatrically wrong with them, everyone feels fear. You have to make the decision. Is that what causes me to decide my strategy? Am I going to, you know, think, oh no, if I do that, then oh, this is going to be terrible. That's not the way to make a decision. And so David, although he knew he was vulnerable, he took his shot. He took his chance and is a great example of being courageous. Most of the most important things you will do in your life scare you. But if you use fear, if fear is the factor, as Joe Rogan used to say, for you, then you're going to miss out on almost everything that's worthwhile in your life. And then finally, faith. Are you going to trust God? Are you going to commit it to God? Are you going to be, because here's the thing, if you're really trusting in God, he helps you prepare. And he helps you strategize, and he helps you deal with your fear, and ultimately helps you to gain the victory. So all of those things, so important for us in our daily lives, especially as we consider some of the giants that we face. Am I preparing myself, taking care of myself, and getting ready for the future? Am I someone who is strategizing, intelligently asking myself, what is a creative approach to this challenge and this problem? Am I acting in fear, or am I courageously moving forward? And then ultimately, is it all in God's hands? Am I committed to Him? If I perish, I perish. Don't make decisions based on fear. Find that faith in God. Faith is something that conquers fear. So that's the story of David and Goliath. Now, we all love this story, and I think we all need it because we all face Goliaths in our lives. When I think of David and Goliath, the picture that comes to my mind, the best illustration I can of this story that I've seen in my life, was about 20 years ago, 2001, California State High School Wrestling Championship. It was the year that Calvary Chapel High School won our seventh state championship. And pretty big deal. No other team, one other team, Clovis had won more, but we're the only one still that has won seven. So we had a kid on the team. He goes to our church, Steve Davidson. His name was Steve Esparza back then. But Stevie was a 125-pound wrestler. He had beaten everyone all year except this one guy from Poway named Andy Kim, who was a monster. Andy Kim, you had to cut weight and make that weight one time during the year in order to do it at state. And so Andy had cut one time for five counties and had beat Stevie. Other than that, Stevie was undefeated. Here they are in the finals of the state championship. The gym is packed, people are surrounding, and here's their match. And Andy Kim was huge. He probably, by the time the match started, he was probably 20 pounds heavier than Stevie, at least. He was a monster. And he got ahead 3-0 right away. He ended up getting a takedown and then riding him. And then second period, Steve let him up. So it's 3-0. Now it's the third period. Stevie needs some kind of a miracle. But Andy Kim is just using his size, and he's just circling and stalling. He knows he has his first state championship. All he has to do is not mess it up. And so it comes down to the wire. Finally, towards the end, Steve shot. He went for his legs, and Andy Kim just got a hold of him in a front headlock, and he's just holding him there. And it's so frustrating. And Stevie ends up, there's 18 seconds left, and he looks over at the coach, John Azevedo, and John goes, "Hit it!" And he did a move that's, everybody's seen it goofing around. Nobody does it at state. It's called a cement mixer. What you do is, when somebody has you in that front headlock, you actually put yourself on your back. You throw your body onto your back, and the momentum, if you're lucky, will turn the guy. And everyone's watching. I remember, you know, us down there by the mat, and I'm like, is he going to do it? And he looks over at John, and John goes, "Hit it." And Stevie throws himself onto his back and then continues to roll through. So he's got a 2-point reversal, but he puts him on his back, gets a 3-point near fall. He actually pinned him, but the referee was so stunned, he didn't even see the pin. And so then I think he let him move and got another three, ends up winning 8-3 and winning the state championship. And Andy Kim never really did much of anything after that. I think it broke him kind of psychologically. Sorry, Andy, if you're here. But so, like, for me, that was like, that's David and Goliath. Did Steve prepare? You bet. Man, he was one of the hardest working wrestlers. He had done this since he was like 8 years old. He was ready for it. At the same time, strategy, this was a crazy move, but it was the only possible way he could take advantage of a bigger guy who was stalling. Did it take courage? Do you want to get pinned in the finals, or do you want to lose 3-0? It took such courage for him to make this move, but he wanted it that bad. And ultimately, at the end, as he stood there, state champion, and I'll never forget the moment as they raised his hand and he's just giving God the glory and we're all celebrating. It's like, that's David and Goliath. By the way, if you go on YouTube to this day after 20 years, if you Google like greatest high school wrestling match ever, you'll see the end of this match. It was so cute. They go to our church and his wife, Natalie, on one of the videos I watched this week, they interviewed her. She was his girlfriend at the time. They go, "So, did you think he was going to lose?" She goes, "No, he had it all the way. I knew he had it." Faith is contagious, by the way, you know. And that's what we can do with our lives. The truth is, every one of us sometime in life, we're down and the clock's ticking away and our opportunities are limited. What do we do? First of all, prepare for that moment. A person who's out of shape, spiritually, physically, emotionally, psychologically, won't be ready for those kind of challenges. But once you've done your homework, now you go, what could possibly give me an advantage or an angle? What might work that people wouldn't expect instead of just doing what's expected? Then if I'm scared, that's okay. I like doing things that are scary. I welcome that. Yeah, it's scary, but I'm going for it because I trust a God who does miracles, especially for people who are prepared and strategize and courageous and will give me the glory, God says. And so I don't know what your giants are. You know, maybe you have issues in your life, habits that you're having a hard time kicking, or people who are making your life miserable, or relationships that are being buried, or kids that don't cooperate, or a job that stinks, or you don't have a job and can't find one, or you know, you're fighting medical problems or whatever. Hey, take care of yourself, but start looking at strategy and using courage, and you'll see you can conquer your giants too. By the way, the greatest giant you will ever face isn't Goliath. In fact, the greatest threat to David was not Goliath. The biggest threat to David, just like the biggest threat to you and to me, is that person that looks back at you in the mirror. Goliath didn't have a chance against David. David almost took himself out. He was his own worst enemy. His flesh almost destroyed everything that he had worked for. And for you, your greatest enemy, probably you. He is a you, your alter ego. It's a monumental threat to what happens to you. But if you live your life in a way that prepares for every temptation that may come along, and if, as you do, you take steps to strategize how not to do self-destructive, stupid things, how to do things that are going to bring about the best results, don't settle for things that don't work. Look for things that will. Utilize courage. Say no to fear. And ultimately, commit it all to God, who, in faith, he will help you with those other three steps as well. You do that, you can take down giants too, even if the giant is you. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for this great story. It isn't just, wow, cool, look what David did. But it speaks to each of us. We all are sometimes outmanned in certain ways, but you always give us advantage in other ways. Help us to do everything we can to be in shape physically, psychologically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, so that we are able to clearly consider the strategies that we can use that aren't expected. And Lord, ultimately, help us to say no to fear, yes to courage, and by having faith in you, committing it to you and giving you glory, to win the ultimate victory. Please teach us this lesson before it's too late for some of us. Thank you. In Jesus' name, amen.